Well, thank you and good morning, and hopefully everybody's had their coffee and is awake and aware. I apologize up front, I've not been feeling well today, so I'm a little shaky up here, but I also wanted to introduce my colleague Linda Burhan-Stepanoff, who has been part of this study. And we have no financial problems, and the information of this talk, even though it was funded by a CDC project, does not necessarily represent any of their ideas, as a disclaimer. So we wanted to first thank the people who had been in our particular study, and we'll get to that, what they are. I think, kind of as a background, Native Americans, as a rule, suffer from many health disparities. You know, our focus is cancer, so that's kind of what we're going to talk about here, even though even if you have health disparities in cancer, you also suffer from many of the other health disparities in terms of access to care. So this is in many ways just the tip of the iceberg. In general, people are diagnosed at a later stage of cancer, which of course means that they have poor outcomes. They experience long delays between when they're diagnosed with cancer and when they enter treatment. And this is just kind of a summary of the high points of barriers that have been well documented over a large number of studies. So, like I said, we're just kind of being summary here. And part of the problem with the delay between getting your diagnosis and getting into care is because those are often very different healthcare systems. If you get diagnosed through state BCC-EDP program, once you need to get into care, you've got to enter a whole different kind of access route. Not necessarily unique to Indians, but they disproportionately are influenced by those different healthcare systems. And we have a much poorer five-year survival rate, as you can tell pretty much from the above problems. So I wanted to talk a little bit about American Indian and Alaska Native health systems, because people kind of have this idea that, oh, American Indians are covered by Indian health services, and so we don't have to worry about them. And that's really not true. Indian Health Services offers basic clinical care services to most federally recognized tribes, and that doesn't necessarily mean they offer it at the tribe. They may have to go 50, 100 miles to another tribal area where the clinic actually is. So even though we talk about it being there, it's not necessarily physically there and easily accessible. And there are a small number, I think 32 different urban Indian health care programs, and like four of those are in Montana. I'm not sure many people would consider those urban areas, but I think that's kind of where the legislation originated, and you know, so we have four in Montana. But the point is that the large major metropolitan areas, where over half of Native Americans live these days, have very few Indian health service programs that they can access to get care. Some tribes have independent programs where, through some kind of funding, they've been able to underwrite their own health insurance, or they have been able to take their money out of Indian Health Service and create their own health care program where they can have more control over how that health care is done. But these systems serve a diminishing proportion of American Indians, and we'll get to that a little bit later. So the clinics focus on urgent care, leaving many chronic conditions underserved. The clinics are severely underfunded, some run out of funds maybe even as early as February, and they don't get new funds until October, which is the new fiscal year. And they have many months where, of course, care is scarce at that point in time. And cancer care may be offered through contract care services, which is a way to augment the Indian health care services depending on their funds. And I just want to note that there are some other factors that are not on this particular slide, like many of the doctors that serve in these Indian Health Service clinics are paying off their medical school and things like that, so they're often only there for 2 years. There's been one estimate that at this point in time, about a third of those who are in that program do not speak English as their first language. So you've got providers that don't necessarily speak English that well in many of these clinics. So the purpose of this study is not to really focus on the barriers, but what people have done to overcome the barriers. There are so many different studies in Indian country that have made these long lists of barriers, and then everybody kind of sits back and goes, oh, darn, you know, that's a lot to overcome. And we don't seem to make the next step to actually starting to address them or overcoming them. Now, you know, regardless of what we do from a health system perspective, the patients out there have to. You know, to get their care, they have to negotiate this system. And so we wanted to kind of find out what was working for them. I won't call it a best practice. So we conducted focus groups in four different states. One group was excluded from the analysis because its particular sample turned out to be unique and didn't really fit with the rest of the study. So all participants in this was a program evaluation, and they were told up front, you know, if you come to this group, it's going to be publicly available information, and they all signed a consent form to let their information be public. And for our purposes, we like to put people up on our website with their stories and things like that so that everybody can benefit from people's stories, and that's part of the process that we put in place for this particular study. We had two of our staff conduct the thematic analysis and list a set of things that help people overcome their access to care. So in these three focus groups that we were pulling this from, they were disproportionately women, middle-aged. They almost all had had a recent urgent or chronic care condition, and a few of them did have cancer. Most of them were IHS eligible, and I'm not going to really talk about the eligibility criteria except to say that if you reside in your reservation where you are recognized as a Native American, you have accessed care to those Indian health services. But if you're married to somebody from a different tribe and you live on their reservation, there may not be the same kind of access to care that you would have. And then remember that we've got those very few urban Indian clinics that do take people who have any background, but it gets very complex very quickly. And if you want to talk about fragmented care, this is the example. It's like a shattered glass. Most people had had insurance at one time through employers, and when we talk more a little bit about the results, that'll be more relevant. I think most Native Americans fall into the same misconceptions that everybody else does. They think they have an Indian health service. They look at it like it's insurance, even though it's not. And so many people think that they've got care, even if they don't. And so if they move to an urban area, they kind of assume that they have access to those services, but they, until you have a healthcare problem, none of us know how good our insurance is. Okay? And we all probably are overestimating in this climate, even with healthcare reform, what our insurance actually covers. Because you really don't know until the rubber hits the road, literally there. So, the urban Indian clinics that they go to, they kind of assume that they can easily get into a hospital system and that they, if they need that level of care, and that the clinic itself will be able to serve all of their needs. But part of the mismatch is that a lot of the people who are paying off their medical bills have specialized because they think that's going to get them, you know, in the career that they want to beyond this particular level of service that they're giving to the community. Well, that doesn't mean that if they specialized in cardiology and now they're in an Indian healthcare clinic, they've had a little bit of experience setting bones and things like that, and that urgent kind of care is what they do, but they may not really know anything very much about cancer care, which, like any other kind of specialized care, becomes very quickly complicated and difficult to provide well if you really have not studied in that area. So even people who have cancer who go to these clinics assume that they're going to get a level of care that they're not getting. The respondents quickly learn what cities are going to give them better services than not, and about half of the people in our focus group said that when they moved to the city, they anymore moved to a city where they knew they could get care. Okay, so very few of us, when we're thinking about where we're going to move, think, well, you know, that's where I'm going to be able to get care. This was forefront in the people's minds who we were talking to. When seeking care, when they weren't eligible, the first thing they said was that they would go to the social services that was available there. And unfortunately, many of them who went to social services, the first response they got is that, well, you're Native American, you have Indian Health Service, you don't need anything. You know, there's no way I can help you, which is really not true. In every state in the United States, American Indians are eligible for state-funded indigent care programs and Medicaid programs. And it's this misconception, really, that is a problem. And so what we heard were people who kept going back and trying to get a different social service worker until they found one that would fill out their paperwork and help them be eligible. Okay, so what we were talking about was, you know, months, not just weeks, of trying to come back at a different time when somebody else would be there trying to get somebody to hear them. Most were able to get some kinds of reservation health services when they drove from the urban areas to the reservation areas, and we'll pick that theme back up in just a second. Many described discrimination in seeking health care, both within and outside of Indian Health Services. For example, when they came in, people assumed that they had substance abuse problems and things like that, even if they had never had a drink of alcohol, and tried to refer them into those programs inappropriately in those particular examples. And that's not the only kind of discrimination that they described, but it certainly was one that affected their ability to get the care that they needed at the time. The people who had work insurance, it was really an interesting discussion because they would say, oh, when I was working, I got to go to a different hospital. You know, I got to do all of these kind of things. I could go down the hall and get my prescription services. You know, they were like, this was this beautiful Nirvana world. When they had a job where they felt like they actually did have access to care and they didn't have to negotiate all of these different care systems. And, you know, it was funny from my perspective in many ways, because what they were describing as ideal care, I would say, was kind of in the medium to lower end of care. But for them, it was so much better than what they had described or what they had experienced in their lives that, like I said, this was really what they saw as ideal care. So, you know, one of the first things we heard in there is, you know, what are you going to do to overcome? Well, I've got to get a job. You know, and I've got to get a job that is going to give me a level of care, because many of these people had temporary jobs or part-time jobs where they were excluded from the insurance categories. And so, and they also didn't necessarily know what kind of jobs gave them, you know, this kind of insurance. But, you know, it's not like we put on the benefits up there on the job description. But that's what they thought was the number one solution to the problems that they had, was getting a job. In urban healthcare settings, sorry, it's a little off there, they thought that the urban healthcare settings were better for general clinical services as opposed to the reservation. And again, when they talked about the reservation, they would talk about some person there who didn't even speak English, and they weren't sure that they ever got, you know, the kind of care that they were supposed to get because of the communication issues that they had. But they also thought that it was more difficult to get prescription services in the city because the urban Indian clinics didn't all have prescription services, and the prescription services they had were generally for chronic conditions, like if you had diabetes, and they would have diabetes prescriptions, but they wouldn't necessarily have something for cancer. So again, a lot of these people started going back to the reservation, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I know I'm getting short on time, in order to get their prescription services and getting their health care in the city. So we start seeing what we've heard a lot about is this circular pattern between the urban areas and the rural areas in order to get piece together something that would satisfy their healthcare needs. They also thought that specialty care was only available in the cities, and that is really true for most reservations. Very few have any kind of cancer care services, for example. So when I say people drove as many as 5 states back to their home reservation in order to get prescription services, you know, it didn't make sense to me, but that was what they thought is their only way to do it if they didn't have to pay out of pocket. And everybody in every focus group that we did knew people who had diabetes, for example, who were not getting their prescription services because it was too hard to drive back to the reservation and they saw no other way of getting their care. So these are untreated people not accessing any care system at all. One quote was from the reservation, "Oh yeah, they can set your arm, but they can't make you feel better." They also thought that the reservation services were full of errors. For example, one woman had a story where she had 3 children, and when she took them into the clinic, they kept filing their medical records in the wrong child's file, and one of them had asthma, and all their asthma records were in their brother's file. You know, they talk about all these real problems that they've had, and we've already talked a little bit about this going back and forth. Again, the reservations were kind of seen as being behind many of the standards of care. And to move further, many people mentioned that it was harder to get care every year. They thought that it was there were diminishing resources everywhere. And there was a growing concern about medical doctors and other people who didn't speak English and the problems that they had there. So most of the people in our group described being denied care at least once, either from the social services to the clinics to whatever. And what they felt was that they kept coming back, if they kept pitching their story a different way, that somebody somewhere would let them in. And most of them were able to tell stories where that actually did happen, where the rules were bent for eligibility for them to get there. And literally, this is no stone unturned. In conclusion, we really don't know how health care reform is going to affect Indian Health Services or other tribal programs. It's kind of missing from the general discussion of what health care reform is and how it would affect people. There certainly is a lot of hope, and again, probably an over-feeling that they're going to be able to get care when they may not be able to. They already live with many uncertainties in this fragmented system. Rationed care is already there. When the clinic runs out of money, they know they've got to wait X number of months until the new funding comes in. Eligibility is key, but as I said before, if you knock at the door enough times, you're going to find somebody who lets you in. And that was the key. And thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Excellent. Do we have a quick clarifying question for Dr. Seals?
Sure. Sounded like increasingly they were acute and urgent care needs that were being addressed, orthopedic, what have you. Is that an evolution of process, or was it always designed to be an urgent care system? Is primary care supposed to be available at an IHS clinic and just isn't, or?
Boy, that's a really complex question. Primary care is supposed to be available at most Indian healthcare systems. Right, and they're supposed to have these referral systems and things like that. The reality becomes starkly different. Every year, people get together and they put a priority system of what they're going to cover or not, because they know they're not going to be able to cover everything. And what's always at the top is urgent care. But I even know one reservation where they had a multi-car accident and it basically wiped out all their health care system, all their health care dollars. That's the February example. And then there was just nothing really for the rest of the year for anybody. So, you know, urgent care, they cover because they have to, but it doesn't necessarily, it was never planned to be that way, but it's like a third of the funding that they would need to be fully functional is what they have. Yeah.
I know that in Canada, catastrophic system. Mm-hmm. Certainly, they have a lot of what I would consider to be frontier areas. Mm-hmm. There. Is there anything available like that funding?
I really don't know if they have short-term needs funding. Most of the grant funding that they have are for special programs like a diabetes program or, you know, something like that. I don't know that they have a fill the gaps fund. To my knowledge, they don't. Is that, yeah.
Well,